Good evening. Nice to see everyone. As you can see, my cat has joined us again. She actually just jumped up only 1 minute before the bell rang and surprised me in my sitting. Usually it's the opposite. She sits for the whole time and then runs away when the bell rings. So we'll see what happens. It's appropriate that she's the one who comes. Her name is Muji, so she is Mu. She also was a gift from the Sangha, so maybe she feels some affinity for us all. I don't know. So as I was thinking earlier about what could I say tonight, and never knowing if I will say something, never knowing who will be present, I know I will be, but I never know who else will be. And I, not long before I signed in, I saw that Tiago had sent a message saying he was having trouble signing in. And I thought, well, maybe I will open the session and no one else will be there. Obviously, something happened because when I came, Tiago and Christine were here. So somebody opened the session. I don't know how it happened, but, and this is a great practice of not knowing. So when I was thinking of what I would say, or what I might say, or what could be appropriate, what was present for me, I had read recently something that from a Theravada tradition teacher who is dead now, who said that, who told the story about how the Buddha had been walking in a forest with his disciples and at one point asked them, something about, well, I forget exactly what the question was, but his answer was that the things that he asked them something about if his teachings were as numberless as the leaves in the forest, or the leaves, a handful of leaves. And they, of course, said all the leaves and as many as the leaves in the forest. And he said, "Well, actually, what there is to be realized is as infinite as the leaves in the forest. But the things to be taught and practiced are few. A single handful of leaves is it. It's not huge." It's not beyond our capacities, our capabilities. Because if we say, oh, you know, the things that are to be taught and practiced, it's as infinite as the leaves in the forest, well, it seems a bit overwhelming, right? So he said, no, you know, it's a single handful. And he said, and this is the quote, the basic teaching, the summation of all his teachings is, nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. We shouldn't cling to anything as I or mine. And he said that's the summation of his teachings. And he said, because one, And I don't know what the phrase is in Sanskrit or Pali, but there is a phrase, but it translates as nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mind. And he said, one, to have heard that phrase is to have heard everything. So if you've heard that one phrase, you've heard it all. That one leaf, you've heard all the leaves in the forest. To have put it into practice, with that one phrase that you heard into practice is to have practiced everything. And to have reaped the fruit, to re have reaped its fruit of that practice is to have reaped every fruit. Which makes it sound really simple, doesn't it? That if you've heard that phrase, everything is included in hearing that, in that phrase of hearing it, because it's the teaching is all about suffering or dukkha, and an end to that. And if you've heard that phrase, you've heard that. That's the only teaching you need to hear. Nothing is to be hung on to as I or mine. And that's the end of suffering then, because that's the cause of our suffering, is clinging, grasping, rejecting, all of that. But if we don't do that, if we hear that phrase, nothing is to be held on to as me or mine, then everything is contained within that phrase. And all of the practices are contained in that phrase. What else is there to be practiced apart from that? If we really practice that, letting go of self, of I, mine, not clinging, not grasping, not hanging on, then there's nothing else to be practiced. It's all there. And the fruits that we reap of that practice, meaning, we are free of delusion. The delusion of separation of I, mine, yours, not mine, that's of self, other, free of that delusion. The fruit of that is that we discover our true original mind. I'm looking at the Dharma names here. So we discover the perfect way, we discover infinite sky. We discover what is it? What is Marlin's? The subtle source or something like that? No, the infinitely subtle source or mysterious source, something like that, Marlin?
No, it's the wild source.
The wild source, exactly. It's much simpler than the infinitely subtle. It's the wild source. Yeah, exactly. It's the true way, it's the bright moon, That's what the fruits are. There's one fruit, but that's all the fruits. I thought, wow, this is really this is such a simple way of putting it. And we talk about this guy, the Buddha. He was like really a fabulous pedagogue, just this really simple, which was the fruit of his realization. So he said, I've realized. My realizations are as numberless as the leaves in the forest, because it's a realization every moment. It's not, and each moment is different. But the teaching and the practice are just that, that one phrase. Hearing that phrase. And when we say hearing that phrase, you've heard everything. Well, sometimes we don't really hear it, or we hear it over and over again, and then finally, oh yes, of course, we really hear it. Sometimes we feel like suddenly, I know I used to, I said this to my teacher once after a Dharma talk. I said, wow, that was really illuminating, your talk. It was about suffering or something. It was definitely about suffering, but I don't know what detail. And I said, that was really illuminating. You should talk about that more often. And she kind of looked at me and she said, "Well, I talk about it all the time, Amy, you know. But sometimes at one moment we suddenly hear it." Or I know my Dharma brother Frank, we used to have this discussion where way back in the day, he realized something. I don't remember what it was. And he said, "Oh, you know, I feel like all of these teachings and all these teachers, they're always not really telling the truth. They're not really saying it." And my view at that point was that yes, they're always saying it, but we don't hear it, you know. When we finally hear it, we totally hear it. The rest of the time, you know, we can hear it conceptually. We both kind of laughed, Frank and I, when we came to that realization. To say that the ancient teachers have all been lying is kind of weird, you know, or not fully telling the truth. It was funny, actually, after he said it. So to have heard that phrase is to have heard everything. Well, we really have to hear it, you know. And then to put it into practice is to have practiced everything. So imagine you hear this phrase, nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. Okay. So then, you know, you're having difficulty in a relationship, you know, whether it's work, family, partner, friend, whatever it is. So you're in a difficult situation, you're not able to really express what you mean and all of this. And you often it's has to do with me and you know, me and mine and yours. So you're blaming the other one, you feel like the other one doesn't understand you. You wish the other person would do something else. You don't agree with what they're saying. All of this, my. And if you dropped that, if you didn't cling to it as me, I, you, yours, well, that opens this space in what's happening. And it doesn't mean that you're not feeling what you're feeling, but you're not identified with it anymore. Even if it's just for a split second, you know. And that changes then how you relate to the other, how you experience the situation, how you speak with the other. This is kind of on a micro level of our own personal happenings, you know, in our life. And we can even then explore what it is that we're feeling, but from this space of not being identified with it. And we can even see the unfurling of the karmic unraveling that has led to this moment, you know, this karmic unfolding. Oh, I'm feeling this because when I was a child, this happened to me, or this is what my mother said, or this is what this person said to me before, and so I'm still remembering that they said that, and I'm hanging on to that, and I was hurt by it then, and now I'm hurt by it again. We can open that and not be like caught up in it, even when we continue to look at it. It's no longer my identity, mine. It's just what has happened. It's just what's unfolding here and now. Given all these innumerable circumstances that have brought us to this moment. So we can see this on our own individual micro level, and we can look around us and see it on the wider macro level of how wars begin, about how neighborhoods might. You know, how gangs in neighborhoods would fight. I'm just like picking like the really, you know, obvious things that are caused by identifying with self and rejecting other, you know, or even, you know, building a fence around my garden, wanting the other to take down their wall so my garden will have more sun. Whereas the people who have their terraces, you know, their patios on in the sun that are built on that wall, well, they are enjoying the sun they're getting. And it's blocking my sun. Isn't that odd? My sun, your sun? Funny, isn't it? And we can look at how many circumstances, every circumstance. He said, if you hear this and you put it into practice, then you're practicing everything. How can we even make a separation between my practice and my life, or my practice and your practice? At the moment, I'm involved in the middle of this healthy boundaries course that I teach. And oh boy, the stories we hear, the stories that are absolutely, from real live situations of people's practice situations with teachers, with sanghas, with power, with discrimination, with abuse, with all this stuff, And if everybody just heard that phrase, nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine, and put it into practice, the fruits of that would be this course I'm teaching would have no reason to exist. Of course, that's completely unrealistic, right? Because in the relative world, we don't always hear that phrase. We don't always put it into practice, and we don't always enjoy the fruits of that practice. Sometimes we get the rotten fruit from not having put it into practice, not having heard the phrase. Sometimes the rotten fruit is the fruit, though. There's delicious, fabulous wine that is made from rotten grapes. So even if we cling to the idea of, oh, the grapes have to be just this way or not this way, we're clinging to identifying something as how we want it or not want it. And that's the same thing as, clinging to I or mine. It's really just, unfathomable that when we look at this, that's why he said it's as numberless as the leaves in the forest. And yet, it's the teaching and the practice is just what we can hold in our hand. And we don't even hold it in our hand. We have to open our hand in order to practice it. We have to let go of those leaves in our hand and to practice it in order to receive the fruits, which are, the one fruit is to discover our true nature, our true face, our original mind, our original face before our parents were born, as we say often. Like that's a koan. Original mind, which has no limits, which is not born. Someone said to me recently, yeah, what was it? Something about, Something about not it's hard to understand the unborn or something. It's hard to conceive of the unborn. That was it. There's this saying, this phrase in Zen practice from Bunke, which is always he always talked about the unborn, what is not born. Well, what is not born doesn't die either. In the relative world, of course, all living things are born and die. What is it that is unborn? What is it that is undying? And so someone was saying to me, that's really hard to conceive of. And it's impossible to conceive of because as soon as we conceive of it, then we're in this relative world. But if we can let go of the I and mine, that is the path to no longer conceiving of it, to just experiencing what is here now and here and now. Of course, we also laughed about that because, of course, we saying it's hard to conceive of it, we know what we're talking about. We know that we're saying exactly that the conceptual mind can't conceive of it, so it's hard to do. And the path to freedom or to be free of delusion is to let go of trying to conceive of it, something like that. We've been talking a lot about this kind of thing in our study group with these texts around emptiness. Well, first the texts were about enlightenment, and then the latest text we have is about emptiness, which enlightenment is realizing emptiness. So they kind of go together. But actually, this teaching of the Buddha, nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. That is his teaching on emptiness, or what is called shunyata in Pali and Sanskrit. That's his teaching. It's only that. Nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. And then everything unfolds from that, as we said. To have heard that is to have heard everything. There's nothing that is mine. There's nothing that is I. There's nothing to cling to as I or mine. When he says nothing whatsoever should be, it's not like an order or, this is what you should do, and if you don't, you're bad. It's an instruction on this is the nature of it. The nature is to not clinging to anything as I or mine. Whether it's my, shame for having said something, or my anger at not getting what I want, or my, overwhelming joy at having, accomplished to finished the task. I was cleaning the kitchen or something, whatever, it's really that basic. We can completely, fully experience those things without being attached to them as I or mine. And in fact, when we aren't attached to it as I, mine, then we completely, fully experience it. Because there's nothing held back then. Doesn't necessarily make it easy to be feeling shame or anger or fear, or to make it, because usually those things we want to get rid of. So we don't want to go into them because we want them to go away. But joy, happiness, bliss or something. Well, we sometimes hold back from that because we're afraid it's going to go away. Or we're afraid to let go and fully experience it. In both cases, we're afraid to fully experience it. One because we don't like it, and the other one because we like it, something like that. It seems counterintuitive, and it is. It doesn't make any sense from a logical perspective. But we're not talking about logic here. We're talking about the true nature of original mind. So, and our practice is that. So even if, So someone in the Healthy Boundaries course was talking about a teacher who wants to be free of institution. No institutions, no being attached to, and it was kind of really the Japanese institutions, right? And therefore it's confusing for the students because then there's only this one teacher, this teacher is like all alone. There's nothing else that he's attached to, although he did receive transmission, in a recognized lineage, but he doesn't want any institution. And so I observed to this guy that, or to, I guess, to the whole, addressing that question for everyone, that the institution is not the problem. It's the identity with the institution that's the problem of I, mine. So this guy is identified with not having an institution, which is creating just another institution. He's the institution in that case. And if we don't acknowledge that, then it's true, there's all kinds of dangerous stuff that can happen, you know. So, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. And then we can fully function within an institution. There's no problem there. Even our Sangha, which is wild, so that's why there's a wild source in this Sangha. It's infinitely rigorous, maintaining the practice of nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. There's no, we don't lose the point of that. And that's my intention. At least my practice is that, to not lose sight of that, which is the point. And then whatever it takes to cultivate a practice that helps others to realize that is good. Maybe it doesn't look like something, you know, we may think that having robes and strict zendos and things is what should be done, but as soon as we start clinging to that, then it's not anymore. So everything is in that phrase. And if we put that phrase into practice, everything is practiced. And if we practice everything, then we reap every fruit there is to reap from it. So maybe I'll stop there and see what others have to say, or questions, comments, other subjects, although they will always be this subject, even if it doesn't look like it. So, can we expand our perspective, you know, the peripheral view to include it all, even if it doesn't seem like it's about this subject? It is. Risha.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for the talk, Hoshi. I have a question, but before, what is the phrase? Not to clung in anything that is I or mine.
Right. So the phrase officially translated is nothing whatsoever. That means, I don't know how you translate it in Portuguese, whatsoever, but it's nothing at all should be clung to. Clung is this is awkward conjugation of the verb, but you know, as I or mine. And the I is like this, and the mine is like this.
As I or mine. Thank you very much.
Okay. And there is a Pali version of it, but I don't know it.
I just wanted the phrase so maybe I can rephrase
Yeah.
it in Portuguese
Right.
and let it come to the meditation to see what happens. It's
Exactly.
always a
Make
play.
it a mantra. A mantra. Yeah.
A mantra. I call it a play, but a mantra, of
Yeah.
course.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, but I didn't get the word. You were talking, I'm going to say look alike. Mind of consciousness can't grab it. So you just have to let go this mind. You were saying that our mind, our intellectual mind, I think, can't grab this. I wasn't and kind of understanding that you should Let go of it. So let go of intellectually try to understand it. Just flow it. I don't know. I wanted you to say more about it,
Yeah,
if you can, please.
that's exactly it. I don't remember how I phrased it, but that is the because our discriminating, discursive, conceptual, intellectual mind can only function within those parameters of logic, intellect, discourse, differentiation, and it's incredibly useful. You know, brilliant, the capacity of our mind to do that. It can make absolutely phenomenal beauty, and it can also make absolutely phenomenal terror, you know, tragedy. It can create a nuclear bomb, and it can create fabulous works of art. Same mind. It's the same mind that awakens is the mind that is deluded. In order for it to awaken, however, it has to let go of the parameters that, you know, the differentiation, the separation, the concepts, has to let go of that in order to experience its other faculty, which is non-discursive, non-judgmental, non-differentiation, non-conceptual. Non-intellectual. You know, the only way we can say this is with non. And it's not even actually non because that belongs to the discursive thought. But it's the only way that the language can communicate it is by saying it's not that. We're looking at this in our study group at the moment about these two different uses of language.
So it's within,
It's the same mind.
our faculties. We don't have to, just let the mind go. Okay, not link to an object, to a discourse, to a parameter or whatever. And okay, let it open to its faculties, there its own faculties. Okay, later. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. You know, we have this line in Oroki where we say, because we desire the natural order of mind to be free from clinging, so we desire this, we desire to not cling, we must be free from greed. We chant this in Oroki, right? And if you really listen to that, so it's like the clinging is what. Greed comes from the clinging, but the greed creates the clinging. And that's how we need to just so stop the greed in order to then, you know, so see the greed, see I'm grabbing, I want this, I want this, I want this. See that and drop it. You know, nothing is mine or I. Nothing, we shouldn't cling to any of it. And then we're free from greed. We're free from clinging and we're free from greed. I don't know if that is in following.
Really easy, thank you.
Okay. Okay.
With humor, thank you, Roshi. Obrigada.
Everyone. So, I asked, kind of put it in this relative world we live. And what resonates, it's the this thing that you talk about us, and we have been with it present. It's the to bring to this beef. The mind that is not clinging and the mind that wants things and grab things. So in our best moments, what we can do in our relatives, it's just to have the appropriate response in each situation. So We bring the word situation. So in each situation we have in our commonwealth, we don't choose which mind. We just can reach or be with the appropriate response, or just we do what is appropriate, or we say what is appropriate. Is it also, can we put it in this relative level?
Yeah, absolutely. Because actually, we're not like every moment thinking this, but we practice our, we say we practice, so we sit on our cushion in order to cultivate this. And then, yes, free functioning in the everyday world, we use our discriminating mind to respond to a situation. And if we have practiced this not clinging, then we will respond from a place of not I, but just the natural response to the situation. Not a response that is self-involved, self-clinging, with how I want it to be and how I don't want the other to be or something like that. It's true, yeah. Look at the situation. So, those of you who have followed this ongoing situation for weeks now, I still have this problem with my eyes, right? Which is, it's like a, how do you say that? It's like an acute allergic conjunctivitis, right? So, it was initially from an allergic reaction. That has just become acute, probably because it wasn't treated properly in the beginning, because I was traveling and whatever. So, and the doctor said to the most recent doctor I saw, she said, it's not grave, it's not, c'est pas grave, we say in French, but it's pénible, it's annoying, but it's not like, life-threatening, or I'm not going to lose my view or something. So the whole practice with that is to, okay, well, this is what it is. It was important. It's important to discover what it is, the treatment, take care of it, follow the regime. It's like all this stuff I have to do all the time. And just do it without hanging on to, oh, I don't like this, I don't want this, this is so annoying, or I don't like that treatment I have to do, and then I don't do it, but then that's just going to cause it to last longer if I don't do it. So it all feeds from discriminating mind, which helps us to respond to the situation without becoming attached to this or that as me or mine or my how I want it or don't want it, or my likes, dislikes, whatever. I'm not thinking of that every moment, however, but because I practice this so much, it's easier to do it. However, when things are really annoying like this, it's more of a challenge, right? And even like wanting, oh, maybe I should just wear sunglasses all the time, or whenever I see someone, I say, oh, so they don't think I've been crying or whatever. It's like, oh yeah, or that I'm high. Yeah, this is what my eyes look like. This is a problem I have with my eyes. I don't even do that now. It's just what it is. However, I am going to warn the people in Lisbon who come to the workshop to be careful with those glasses, because that was the origin of my thing, was an allergic reaction to those glasses we wore during the Five Buddha Energy Workshop. But Asha assured me that I am the only one that she's used these glasses with who had that reaction. So maybe it's not common, but it's something to be aware of. And I will not use those glasses. I will have to make something of my own so that I can do it. So that's the discriminating mind that is responding to a situation without judging. Oh, those are bad glasses. How could she have made glasses like that? We should have other glasses. That's pointless, right? But the discriminating mind is important to know that I'm not going to use those glasses again because I know what happened to me. I think, we can all recognize this just in everyday situations in life. Even so, you come here tonight. Your discriminating mind, your conceptual mind knew that this was the time, the place, all of that. And you maybe had expectations. You know that on Thursday night, usually there's a Dharma talk. And usually, unfortunately, I might add, it's always me who talks. But you don't really know. And you completely put aside your discriminating mind when you arrive here and you don't know. It's very natural, actually. You might have a preference. But if you had a preference and you didn't, and what was happening didn't fit with that preference, would you leave? Maybe. If it was a circle instead of a Dharma talk, maybe someone would leave. But I don't think I've ever seen anyone do that. Or, if it's someone else talking, if it's me talking again and you say, oh, no, not her again, would you leave? Probably not. Or if the subject you don't like or you don't understand, would you leave? Or would you complain? Maybe, but probably not. Because our practice, we're so used to cultivating this opening, just being with what is, that we're fluid.
If there was an institution, though, where we could complain, we would.
Absolutely, probably. There is. You could contact my teacher. You could contact the president of Wildflower. Actually, we're working on, seriously, we are working on developing an ethics procedure. So if people do have complaints, ethical or, about abuse of power or anything that doesn't, anything that doesn't feel right, that they will have a place to go in the Sangha. That there will be an institution for that. Because it's useful. It's important. Krisha.
Great, I think it's great. You were talking about the healthy boundaries, also in the Dharma talk. And I remembered that sometimes about these people, the abusive power, alone gurus, people in Sangha that tend to put themselves in a place that it's not them, whatever. I don't know them all, but something I as we all sometimes these persons really have some behavioral problem. I've seen that people like really bad narcissism, or it's compared clinical as as schizophrenia or something like that. And sometimes they really aren't able to see. Once I was talking with you, and I think it was kind of for me to understand. Sometimes I don't understand. And if a person like this is within our Sangha, and I thought it was very beautiful, your answer. It can be like a son, a father, or whatever. It's part of your family. You don't expel him, which is important because we all exist in our myriad of manifestations. But they can be really dangerous for us. It's really important that you White Fowl has a way for us to go. And I think it's also really important for teachers who know this stuff, don't make it a secret, and really don't trust these persons to be responsible for personal growth in the Sangha. They, of course, we all can be in the Sangha, it's very good, but we cannot trust this. This is really, really, we should be attention, and it's great that you're still developing that. Thank you.
Thank you. So I don't remember that I said that to you. However, that is true. However, the person has to be willing to be accountable and work with whatever the consequences of their actions have been, and have, if the entire Sangha is involved in it, then have some kind of process for the Sangha to work through it as well. Some people, that some people don't want to do it, and then they leave. There's a case at the moment in this group that I'm working with where the teachers, they were a couple, and they were very, there were all kinds of transgressions, and they left, and the Sangha basically disintegrated because their people were taking sides. They didn't want to work process it or anything, the teachers. And the people who are telling me all this, telling us this in the, this healthy boundaries, it looks like, in a sense, one of the women, one of the teachers was a woman, the wife, the partner. And it's almost as if the entire Sangha was created to care for her needs. That's how, how deep it can go, how deluded it can be if the person who is leading the Sangha is not clear and has not done work and has not, practiced. And that, of course, that's dangerous. If the entire Sangha is created to care for the teacher, it's the opposite, The Sangha is there to care for everyone, and that the teacher is there to care for the students. Of course, the teacher cares for her himself, but not, it's not the students who are supposed to be taking care of the teacher. The teacher has another, has her teacher or his support, whatever it is. It's not the Sangha who's taking care of the teacher. So that was just, that's just an example of,
Yeah, and you said within this healthy boundaries that if everyone applied the nothing is not cl don't cling to anything of like mine or I, healthy boundaries wouldn't be necessary to be taught.
Well, that this is a utopian view, but yeah.
Yeah, because I mean,
No.
we are far away from having everyone have access to
Right.
these ideas, and I mean, boundaries are
Yeah.
really an important thing, so.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I maybe shouldn't have even said that, but it's like pushing it to the absolute that, you know, what causes the need for, you know, understanding what healthy boundaries are is that people aren't awakened to this. You know, they're clinging, they're grasping, they're rejecting, they're not seeing the boundaries, they're not seeing the transgressions, they're not seeing the harm. They're only focusing on themselves, you know, so.
Yeah, so it's more the other way around that it's that what creates the transgressions.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's it. Because when we see that you and I are one, you know, it's like Bernie Glassman gives the example of the right hand and the left hand. So if the right hand is holding the pen, the left hand will not beat the right hand so they can have the pen. It's one body. And so if we truly see the oneness, if we truly see this emptiness, we will not harm and we will respect, you know, the right hand writes better than the left hand. And the left hand totally honors that. The left hand in this body does not cannot use the pen like the right hand. Totally respects that. And in a sangha, it's like that too. Everyone has their place. And one is not better than another. But there are differences and the hierarchies, the power dynamics, they need to be respected. Otherwise, just untold damage and trauma and just tragic stories of what happens. Any community, any family, any workplace, something, when the boundaries are not respected, it's dangerous. It's trauma.
Yes, and also when people are not conscious of their own power and re and ready to give it away or to.
That's really dangerous when people don't acknowledge their power, when they don't own it. Yeah, that's really dangerous. And not owning it, you know, I know for myself when I was a young teacher, it was hard for me to own the power. That I really had to work at that. But there's a lot of self-clinging involved in that. You know, there's a lot of me
In not wanting the
and not
power.
wanting it. Yeah. Not wanting it, not thinking I can do it, not wanting to impose on other, you know, all this I stuff involved with it.
I still remember the first lines of your Dhamma talk in the Belgium retreat where Michel had his transmission. You have been the oldest successor. You are the first successor of Catherine, and so it was yours to open the to give the first Dharma talk. And you started with that that it's for you to lay the first stone, and it's not about I, because I would not do it. You said something like that.
Yeah. I don't remember what I said, but I do remember that was a very difficult moment. So,
At that time, it was difficult for you to give this first
well,
talk.
it was particularly difficult because usually, you know, it's Geno Roshi's, it's Dana Sashin, and she would have given the first talk. But for reasons because she was not well and she was involved with the whole transmission and everything. I was put into the position of giving the first talk, and I felt like it wasn't really appropriate that I should give the first talk because nobody was there to hear me.
I was
Everybody,
there.
Yeah, you were the actually some of my students were there, yes, and that was wonderful. I'm always grateful when my students come to those kinds of gatherings.
Yeah, we were not a lot.
No, I forget who else was there, maybe.
Sophie was there.
Yeah, you and Sophie, and maybe that's no, there must have been somebody else.
Maybe Joa
Oh, Joa probably was there.
or Lisa.
I don't think Lisa was. No, Sophie was my attendant.
Sophie was your attendant.
Yeah.
We went there with your car, and we were four, I guess, or even five.
Yeah, maybe Tomas, Freddie, I don't know.
Freddie, maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
When was this? Do you know? Can do you know what year?
2014.
Thank you.
2014. And so I was really resenting that I was put in this position of having to give the first Dharma talk because I thought she should do it. You know, it's her sangha, it's her thing. There's 150 people here. They're not there to hear me give the first Dharma talk, whatever. So, you know, I had to drop all that. I had to let go of it all. And I guess it was okay. I mean, I'm sure it was okay, but I don't remember what I said.
I only remember these, even still with the gestures, the lay the first stone, and that was so it had an impact, the rest I don't remember. I'm sorry,
Well, that's
but
great. I'm glad. I'm happy to hear that. Yeah.
yeah, that was something that stick with me, and I often think of that,
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, and that's that. Yeah, I had to let go in order to put that stone down. Really had to let go. So, we're out of time. Unless someone wants to add one thing. Everything has been said, as we say, you know, everything has been heard, everything's been said, practiced, reaped. Here we are. Thank you.
So nice to see you all. Thank you, Roshi. Thank you, everybody.